I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. We begin today with the latest from the Middle East, where fighting between Israeli forces and Hamas militants continues for an 11th day. The U.S., Egypt, Qatar, France, and other nations have been working in the U.N. and through back channels to persuade both sides to end the hostilities. There is some optimism that a ceasefire could begin as early as tomorrow. Joining me with analysis and perspective is Ishan Tharoor, a foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Post. Plus, an update on a Baltimore City program in which taxpayer money is dedicated to a fund to provide programming and support for our city's young people. Davon Love and John Morris join me to talk about the Baltimore Children and Youth Fund. That's all coming up on Midday after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. Good to have you on board. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. President Biden has called Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu several times since the conflict in the Middle East began last week, amid increasing calls from the international community to stop the violence that has killed more than 200 Palestinians and a dozen Israelis. On Tuesday, Biden told the Israeli Prime Minister that he expected a, quote, significant de-escalation on the path to a ceasefire in this latest conflict between Israel and Hamas, which is now in its 11th day. Buildings and basic infrastructure in Gaza lie in rubble. Hamas militants have fired more than 4,000 rockets into cities and towns across Israel. Joining me now is Ishan Tharoor. He's a foreign affairs columnist at The Washington Post, and he joins us on Zoom. Ishan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What do you see as the big differences in this conflict from prior conflicts? The last one was in 2014, both on the ground in Gaza, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and here in Washington. How do you see these, what's going on now, different from prior conflicts?
Sure, and that is a quite meaty question, and there are a number of different components to it, so let me try to slowly unpack that. As you've indicated, Hamas has fired probably over 4,000 rockets at this point, and that's compared to 2014, that's roughly the same amount of munitions fired by Hamas as it did 7 years ago, except in a fraction of the time. So we've seen in this conflict that this militant Islamist group that controls the Gaza Strip certainly has tremendous capacity still to inflict a threat or to pose a threat to Israel, and the willingness to really test Israel's sophisticated defenses with munitions that are more sophisticated than what they had 7 years ago. So we're seeing a steady accumulation of Hamas's resources over the past few years. Israel will now claim, as it did in 2014, that they have degraded those capacities and once again struck at Hamas's sort of militant infrastructure, including these subterranean networks beneath the Gaza Strip, where Hamas has smuggled arms and maintained various room for maneuver through these tunnel networks. So to a certain extent, we will see after the ceasefire swings into place, probably tomorrow, similar kind of rhetoric about calm restoring, a degree of calm returning, about Israel. Israeli authorities will probably say that they have crippled Hamas in various ways, though there is clear sense that Hamas is going to emerge relatively intact, as it did 7 years ago. But then, as you said, there are massive differences between the ways in which this conflict has played out now and last time in 2014. First of all, it's pretty important not to bracket what's happened in Israel and the Palestinian territories over the last few weeks as purely a Hamas versus Israel conflict. That's not the case. This is a conflict that was stoked first and foremost by clashes and unrest in Jerusalem, which is not near the Gaza Strip, which is involves where the where you can argue that the provocative elements were not Palestinian militants, but Jewish extremist groups. Who had launched days of marches through Arab neighborhoods, who had, and then of course, an ongoing kind of activist, local grassroots Palestinian resistance to Israeli moves to evict some residents of a East Jerusalem neighborhood. And that all spiraled into a series of events that saw Israeli forces storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque, you know, the third holiest site in Islam. And that provoked Hamas to take a kind of opportunistic stance, perhaps, and fire its rockets, and that provoked the war. But then what we saw was this violence spiraling across the region. You saw in cities within Israel's 1948 borders, clashes between Palestinian citizens of Israel and Jewish Israelis, and a level of violence that has not been seen in years. And then you also saw yesterday a huge general strike taking place involving Palestinians in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, and in Israel proper. And that was a kind of display of pan-Palestinian solidarity that we've not seen in decades. So there is a shifting dynamic within Israel as well. And then, of course, there is a shifting dynamic here in the United States, where the Democrats, at least some Democrats, have been much more vocal in their criticism of the Israeli government than ever before, where you have real political pressure on the Biden administration coming from the left, let alone from the right, to change its largely, you know, I would say, somewhat meek approach to the current situation. And you have Democratic lawmakers talking openly about conditioning aid to Israel, talking openly about a status quo there that is untenable. Some even using the word apartheid to describe the state of affairs in Israel and the Palestinian territories. And that, to me, is probably, you know, especially as we think about U.S. policy toward the region, the biggest change.
Yeah, and when we talk about aid to Israel, it totals some $3.8 billion. It's military aid that is unrestricted. And there are those who are calling for, at the very least, to restrict the nature of that aid and what it can be used for. Ishan Tharoor is my guest. He's a columnist on the foreign desk of the Washington Post. He writes today's Worldview newsletter, as well as a column. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Tharoor, what's in it for each side? I mean, here we have in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. In the last 2 years, he stood for election four times. Each time it was indecisive, to say the least. He hasn't been able to form a government. Is the timing of this conflict good news for him in that regard? He's also, been indicted in court. And then what's in it for Hamas leadership? You mentioned that this conflict will likely leave Hamas pretty much intact. What do either side have to gain and lose, and how will that affect the sustainability of a ceasefire?
What I'm about to say is a very cynical reading of what's happened in the last few weeks, but I think it is important to talk through how both, as you said, Netanyahu and Hamas have arguably gained from the violence and misery and destruction that we've seen in the last few days. As you said, Netanyahu has plunged Israel in this kind of interminable cycle of elections over the last 2 years, with the country being unable to form a stable coalition government each time they've had an election, largely because of the politics being so strung around whether Israel keeps Netanyahu in power or not. He's a prime minister, of course, who faces an ongoing series of corruption trials. And he's a figure who's deeply polarizing in Israel, as well as increasingly here in the United States. And what happened last week was that Netanyahu, 2 weeks prior, had failed to form a coalition government after Israel's latest election. And so the mandate to form that government went to the opposition, or to his nearest opponents. But as the violence kicked off, this anti-Netanyahu coalition, which in and of itself was quite a motley crew, collapsed, because you had a right-wing leader who was anti-Netanyahu pull out, saying that it was impossible for him to form a coalition with an Arab party, because there was going to be an Arab party in this coalition. And so that collapsed, and that essentially buttressed Netanyahu's position for the weeks ahead. We don't know, again, whether this anti-Netanyahu coalition will be able to cobble anything together. The likelihood of a fifth election is still there, and so Netanyahu keeps ticking along in power for the time being. On the Palestinian side, and this is also quite complicated, but also very important to think through, you have the status quo there is you have in the West Bank nominal control by the Palestinian Authority and, of course, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who's been there for many years. And in Gaza, you have Hamas, which has held sway since 2007 after it had a violent sort of civil war with the PA and broke free after a series of political events, including elections, that the rest of the world weren't too pleased with. So you've had this dysfunctional status quo for quite some time. There were going to be elections after many years, but then the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas called them off because he sensed how much unpopularity he faced, and he knew that if these elections actually go ahead, he's going to be kicked out of power. And so you had a dysfunctional status quo surrounding all the events in Jerusalem that led to Hamas sensing an opportunity to try to stake a degree of its legitimacy on, you know, standing up for Palestinians elsewhere outside of Gaza. And from what we've seen, according to Palestinian pollsters you talk to, Hamas's actions are not uniformly popular. There are Palestinians who are absolutely infuriated with the group for provoking the cycle of violence. But then there are many Palestinians who see them as the only entity standing up for Palestinians in a context where they are faced a brutal and sustained military occupation, where they live, you know, millions of them with fewer rights than their neighbors, and where they see Israel carrying out a kind of creeping annexation of Palestinian land in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and a continued sort of dispossession of Palestinians that's been going on for years.
You know, it really is quite extraordinary. You have these internecine battles going on between Netanyahu and factions in the Knesset. You have internecine battles going on between factions in the Palestinian community, between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. And you have internecine battles going on in the Democratic and Republican parties here in America. You write about how there is still, of course, bipartisan support for Israel, but the ground is perceptibly shifting, and that more people may start viewing this conflict through a social justice frame, which is interesting given the social justice frame that we are looking at ourselves and have been since the death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. I mean, social justice, equity is top of mind for a lot of people since the Black Lives Matter movement. It's all of a piece in a way. I mean, what's the polling here in America say about how Americans feel? And is there any indication that Congress or President Biden are out of step with how the public is feeling about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, the polling is mixed. And of course, it's always important to take public polling of foreign policy positions with a grain of pinch of salt, because most Americans don't think too concretely or deeply about the U.S.'s foreign policy positions. But I do think that what we're seeing slowly take shape is that while the U.S. discourse is shifting, is going to be shifting on Israel faster than, say, U.S. policy. You had a Gallup poll published earlier this year that found for the first time that a majority of Democrats think the United States should be putting more pressure on Israel rather than less. And that's a pretty significant development internally for the Democrats. You have other polls that suggest a majority of Americans, if given the choice of Israel remaining a situation where there are millions of Palestinians with no real political rights compared to the Israelis, they would choose democratic Israel over a distinctly Jewish Israel. That's a pretty interesting position to have polled. And then, of course, politically, you do have a different cast of characters emerging now. On the left, you have folks like Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, being quite strident on social media, really pushing the envelope a bit in terms of bringing the long-running discourse on the left about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict into the mainstream in Washington in ways that we have not seen before. You also have moderate Democrats who are, you know, pro-Israel stalwarts like Senator Menendez in New Jersey and others issuing statements echoing a degree of criticism of Israel that you would have never heard them say in 2014. So there is a shift within the Democrats. At the same time, this is also a reflection of 4 years of Trumpism. President Trump was not simply a clearly pro-Israel president. He was a president for the Israeli right. He really boosted the cause of the Israeli right by kind of settling all these issues over the Golan Heights, over Jerusalem, basically doling out gifts, political gifts to Netanyahu and his allies on issues that should not have, that successive U.S. administrations, including Republican ones, would never have conceded. These were concessions that were supposed to be part of final status negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. Trump has foreclosed that. Trump essentially scrapped the two-state solution, which has been a policy of successive U.S. administrations, and essentially through his vision for Middle East peace, tried to arrange a scenario where the status quo in Israel was guaranteed, Israeli domination over Palestinian territories was guaranteed, and the Palestinian issue as a whole would be sidelined as Israel normalized its relations with other Arab countries. That was the game plan. That game plan has already collapsed. But now the question is, and this is where the social justice frame is important, there are no real prospects for a viable independent Palestinian state. And so the conversation in Washington that has gone on for so many years about a two-state solution, about a political process, a diplomatic process that would yield a Palestinian state through the channels that have existed for the last few decades, that is more or less collapsed. So the question now is, in the absence of that, what do we talk about? What is important? And that is obviously the rights of Palestinians. So we've gone from a conversation about nationhood and statehood to a conversation about equity and rights. And that is terrain that the Israelis don't really want to be walking on in Washington. And that's very uncomfortable for a lot of U.S. lawmakers, because especially on the Democratic side, what Democratic politician is really comfortable defending the interests of an ethno-nationalist state anywhere in the world? And especially a Biden administration that has signaled up front that it would restore America's kind of fight for human rights on the world stage after 4 years of Trumpism. I mean, this is an immediate test for its alleged values and purpose on the world stage.
Yeah, and clearly a conundrum for President Joe Biden, whose former boss, Barack Obama, sort of famously didn't get along with Bibi Netanyahu. We just have about a minute left here, but what are the indications, given Mr. Biden's, at least public stance in this current conflict, as to how Mr. Biden is going to navigate that tricky path forward that you've just outlined?
Well, it's going to be deeply awkward for him, and it has been clearly quite awkward. It's obvious that when Biden took office, he was not going to really invest much energy. He did not want to invest much energy in this conflict, in finding a truce. He has a whole bunch of administration officials with him who are scarred by their attempts in the first and second terms of the Obama administration to treat with Israel. But now what we're seeing is a scenario where first, he's getting hit from the right for being too lax in his support for Israel. He's getting hit from the left for not doing enough to recognize the rights of Palestinians and recognize the root causes of the current conflict. And so the Biden administration is waking up to the fact that there is no inattention is not an option. That sticking around and not doing very much is not an option, because the U.S. has underwritten the status quo for so long. And we'll see how they try to pivot from a ceasefire to more constructive diplomacy. They may decide that it's not worth it still. And then we'll have a scenario where we go through this cycle of violence and the sort of various new traumas unleashed again all over.
Ishan Tharoor is a columnist on the Foreign Desk of the Washington Post. He writes the Today's Worldview newsletter and column. Ishan, thanks so much. I really appreciate your perspective. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll switch gears and get a progress report on the Baltimore City Children and Youth Fund with the activist Davon Love, who is the community engagement lead, and John Morris, a lawyer who serves as the treasurer of the fund. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. We'll be right back.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.